And on today's Windy City Queercast, we honor the legacy of Matthew Shepard, who 10 years ago this week on October 6th was brutally beaten, left on a fence, and 6 days later in a hospital lost his life, and his time here on the earth ended with us. And yet his life began also with us and his legacy. That legacy was told through the Laramie Project. And on today's show, Kelly Simpkins, my partner, goes back in time and talks to us about 10 years ago and the genesis of that project. Plus, we have head writer Lee Fondakowski of the Tectonic Theater Project also with us to talk about where we are 10 years later and her recent visit back to Laramie, Wyoming, and to see the town 10 years later. Where are they? And where are you? How has your life changed in the past 10 years? This is a very special 10th anniversary Windy City Queercast in honor of Matthew Shepard.
Windy City Queercast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queercast.
Windy City Queercast.
Windy City Queercast.
Windy City Queercast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Kelly Simpkins.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This Queercast is brought to you in part by
Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming.
American Airlines, offering the GLBT community exciting vacation packages online at aa.com/rainbow.
And by Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com.
Listening to the Windy City Queercast, show number 250. This is a special podcast on the anniversary of Matthew Shepard's murder. 10 years later, as we look forward and we look back on Matthew's life, and there's nobody better to be in this podcast with me than my partner Kelly Simpkins. So, Kelly, thanks for being here on this show.
It's my pleasure.
It's kind of a special week, the week in which we. Matthew Shepard was attacked on October 6th and eventually lost his life on October 12th.
Yeah.
So this 6 days, this week is a week, I think, for great reflection on the community and his story and kind of what that has meant to us gay and straight. Of course, we're just going to talk as two lesbians. That's what we are. And I'm sure in our next show, Mitchell Fain will be on with us and we'll talk with him about that as well. Where were you 10 years ago? You were living in New York.
I was in New York. It's funny because, you know, when this happened, 2 months later, I would be meeting Lee Fondakowski and doing my first show with her. And then, in the same month that I met her, they were traveling to Laramie to go back for the Henderson trial. And then, about a few months thereafter, I became involved with the Laramie Project. So I was in a pretty weird place in New York, working in a restaurant, doing some shows here and there, still trying to be a working actor, but really, I wouldn't say on a dead-end road, but on a road that wasn't extremely impactful in any way or meaningful or, you know, one that brought me a super, super delightful amount of joy. And that effectively would change like two months after Matthew died.
And you're talking about Lee Fondakowski of the Tectonic Theater Project, who's also going to be on the show today as she's in town for this big 10th anniversary benefit reading that we're doing to benefit the About Face Youth Theater and also the Matthew Shepard Foundation tonight here in Chicago. And in many cities, people are doing things to kind of honor the life and legacy of Matthew Shepard at this big anniversary marker. Did you ever think when you started your work with the Laramie Project that it was going to be this big?
No.
Did you think in grappling with the material, because you're one of the writers, you're also in the original cast, did you think that, obviously we all knew the story was big. We knew the story was big, but sometimes stories are big and they just go away and they lose their impact, right? Or
No, I mean, it was certainly the first time. I mean, you know, we've all talked about this. It's, I'm not the first one saying this. We talked about it with Laramie. People talked about it, you know. Journalists talked about it. You know, it was the first time, kind of on a global level, that hate crime based on, you know, sexual orientation had any impact on the world at large. Had immediate impact on the straight community and obviously the LGBTQ community, but that reached the proportions that Matthew Shepard's murder did.
Why do you think it did?
Well, I don't know that I can't speak purely from my heart about that. I can only Well, I agree with a few people, you know, that we interviewed and that I've talked to about it. And, you know, I just can't dismiss, you know, the one big thing was that when this happened, Matthew Shepard had two friends, which we don't talk about, which isn't that newsworthy, that immediately called, I can't remember which major network, but they called a major network with the story.
Huh.
It was a breaking story. So there was that kind of immediate dial-up thread with it had just happened and they wanted it to be covered. and also, you know, this woman, Elise Harris, that we talked to from Out Magazine, made some really fantastic points that, you know, most people that are, you know, and she had worked and they had done all these kind of, you know, kind of graphs and things like that on bias crimes and just the numbers on bias crimes and the type of people that are perpetrated in these crimes or the crimes are perpetrated on. And, you know, she said is they're very different than Matthew Shepard. A lot of them are Black, Asian, different ethnicities. I mean, that Matthew, her whole slant, and I feel like I'm taking a long time to get to this, but was that he was a white, attractive, middle-class young man. Middle-class to upper-class. Well, that's right. He was moneyed, he was white, and he looked like a young kid. He looked like a pretty boy. And her main kind of reasoning for why this received the attention that it did was that he looked as if he never had sex yet. So the world at large got to project something onto him that was not sexual.
Hmm.
Whereas with a lot of other bias crimes in this area, you know, and she kind of broke this down into different kind of categories of people who had been murdered, you know, what they looked like, whether they were wearing leather, whether they had handlebar mustaches, whether they were like a drag queen or a peer queen, or whether they were Black and with feather boas. And, you know, we as a society, kind of a global society, don't know what to do with that. I mean, especially if you're in the straight community, it is so attached to our kind of our fear about what homosexuality is, and then it becomes sexualized, and that this murder was not sexualized, that he looked. And she also said, you know, you can't underestimate, even though he wasn't strung up in a Christ-like pose, but you can't underestimate kind of the metaphor of that, the staggering image of this young kid being tied to a fence in a way that you know, was projected in the media as being this Christ-like image.
Yeah.
That kind of imagery and the way that he looked and the kind of class that he was in, and that he looked like a young boy almost who had never done anything sexual, that we all got to fall in love with this kid in a way and care about this kid in a way that we have a hard time caring about if you look like you're screwing other men.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really frank and blunt way to say it, and she didn't say it probably in those terms, but, and I think that's probably a really astute observation.
What was your response the first time that you all read the Laramie Project to an audience? And is it that the moment that you knew? I mean, because now the Laramie Project is one of the 10 most produced plays.
I didn't know. I didn't know when we did it in New York. I don't know that anybody did, but speaking, you know, personally for myself.
You started in Denver.
We started in Denver. We did several workshops and readings prior to that, but we started in Denver, and then we brought it to New York, and then we went to Laramie for a week, and then we did our last two shows, one at Berkeley Rep and one at La Jolla Playhouse. And even then, I mean, once, you know, HBO kind of was on board to kind of do a movie of it, those talks started, I think, fairly early. And that seemed really big to me.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of somebody wanting to make a film of it seemed really big. I mean, obviously it seemed big to me as a performer, but it also just seemed big to me as like a storyline that you know, HBO would want it covered and to create a play around what we had, or to create a film around the play that we had done. But I I had no idea that it was going to take on the significance that it has.
When did you? I mean, when did you know? I mean, we've all done those shows where we like know it's something bigger.
I knew it was a great play. Yeah. I knew the impact of the play.
And the stories and those
and
voices.
And the stories and those voices and the town and just the response that we had when we could get people. We had a hard time getting people to New York. I mean, we only ran for 5 months. We anticipated it being a much longer run, perhaps a year, if not more. And we could not, I think, based on the subject matter, people were scared of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew, there was no doubt in my mind that we had created something extremely special.
Yeah.
That group of people, the chemistry and kind of this karmic destiny that those like 10 or 11 people had in a room is probably something that I hope I find again in my lifetime, but I don't know that I ever will.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until the play, until, you know, I kind of got the data through Tectonic and Moises that people were doing it in high school, that people were starting to do it in colleges, that it was really taking off, that I, you know, really knew. When it was happening, did I really know? It's not that I could not have anticipated it, I just didn't anticipate it.
Yeah.
And I didn't anticipate it being kind of the teaching tool that it has been in high schools and colleges. Like, that has been the most beautiful and unexpected surprise to me. And not that I could not have foreseen that, I just didn't foresee it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. Let's tell you what else is going on. It's a very ripe time in the theater community in Chicago. So many shows going on, plus other stories being told. True stories are based on true characters. Flash of Genius is the movie review today. And we'll be back with Kelly Simpkins and our special 10th anniversary Laramie Project podcast. Now
the movie thrilled millions. The legendary soundtrack won a place in our hearts forever. And now the unforgettable story of Baby and Johnny comes alive in a must-see theatrical phenomenon. This is Dirty Dancing, the classic story on stage, and it's coming to Chicago. Exploding with heart-pounding music, sensational dancing, and breathtaking emotion. This worldwide stage hit will have its U.S. premiere at the Cadillac Palace Theater.
Watch me now.
Dirty Dancing begins performances September 28th. Get tickets now at BroadwayInChicago.com and have the time of your life at Dirty Dancing.
Culture Club.
Culture Club.
Culture Club.
Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Weird.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get
some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of October 6th, 2008, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Forbidden Broadway, New York's acclaimed musical, returns to Chicago with a brand new show for 2008, gleefully ripping through Broadway's biggest hits and flops, including August, Osage County, Gypsy with Patti LuPone, and Young Frankenstein. Playing at the Royal George Theater, visit Ticketmaster.com.
The most successful rock and roll musical of all time, Buddy, the Buddy Holly story, is now playing at Drury Lane Water Tower, featuring classics like La Bamba, That'll Be the Day, Chantilly Lace, and Peggy Sue. For ticket information, visit Ticketmaster.com.
Writers Theater presents Picnic by William Inge, directed by David Cromer. The Chicago Tribune calls it an intensely emotional revival, and the Chicago Sun-Times acclaims every performance is exquisitely shaped. For more information about Picnic at Writers Theater, log on to writerstheater.org.
Weird and wonderful, devastatingly lovely, exclaimed the New York Times when Sarah Rule's Eurydice premiered. Now's your chance to see it in Chicago. Victory Gardens Theater presents Eurydice, a bold, beautiful take on the classic Orpheus myth, a modern-day tale of love and loss told from the heroine's point of view. Don't miss this remarkable production at the Victory Gardens Biograph. For tickets, visit victorygardens.org.
Don't miss Turn of the Century, this season's star-studded musical by the writers of Jersey Boys and directed by Tommy Toon at Goodman Theater. Jeff Daniels and Rachel York star in this romantic romp through time and the American Songbook. Tickets on sale now at goodmantheater.org. And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Let's go to the
I'm Richard Knight Jr. with another Night at the Movies Minute.
Greg Kinnear's excellent performances may get taken for granted, not just because of his matinee idol handsomeness, but also because he's a subtle actor, not an Al Pacino, Kevin Spacey, Dustin Hoffman, scenery-chewing kind of performer. His specialty has become finding complexities in a broad range of likable everyday man characters. Now he plays another in Flash of Genius, the true story, get ready, of the man who invented the intermittent windshield wiper only to have it stolen. The movie, a classic David versus Goliath story, begins in the mid-1960s when Kinnear as Bob Kearns, a college professor and mechanical engineer, has the idea one rainy afternoon for the intermittent windshield wiper. He tinkers around until he has a successful prototype, which Ford agrees to back, but then backs out of the deal without explanation. When Kearns discovers by chance that Ford has installed his invention in their automobiles, he vows to fight until he gets justice. And fight he does for 12 long years, leaving his marriage in a shambles as he defends himself in court, eventually enlisting his children to help him out. This being a movie in the mold of A Civil Defense, Aaron Brockovich, and dozens more, we know that Kearns is going to triumph over his naysayers, but the familiarity of this story doesn't make it any less satisfying. Though Flash of Genius is easily Kinnear's movie all the way, ironically, here is a character where a tad more vinegar, a little more scenery chewing, and a little less of Kinnear's likability and acting subtlety would have helped separate it from the herd of other David vs. Goliath movies and given it that extra spark of originality that it could have used. That flash of genius, if you will. Nevertheless, I think you should go see it. I'm Richard Knight Jr., and that's your Night at the Movies Minute.
So we're here 10 years later. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, you're still involved with this play. How is this play still in your life? I mean, I know you, so I know how many things have happened even in the past 6 months, but how is this play still in your life, even 10 years later?
Oh, I think it, I mean, beyond kind of the external things, which are, you know, I see the play, I give talks, either talkbacks after performance, I talk to actors who are doing it. I've gone to several high schools recently, and, you know, especially when we first completed the end of the Laramie Project and people were really starting to do it in a frenzied sort of way, you know, we all started traveling around and giving talks and you know, talking to kids especially, which is so meaningful to me, who are doing this play, who have been so moved and who fight to do it, who are, get barred at their schools for doing it and
talk
do
about
it anyway.
The LA production recently, because I want to talk about the fact that it's still going on today.
It is still going on today. And then I'll kind of talk about a more personal thing that I feel is really important to talk about, just for me personally. But so first of all, there were four women, three of whom were lesbian, at Burbank High School. And, you know, Lee and I got a call. And when these things happen, like when people are doing the Laramie Project and they have the risk of being shut down, they'll call Tectonic and say, do we have any resources? What can we do about this? So they sent Lee and I out to Burbank, probably, what was that, like 4 months ago, 5 months ago? And these kids were slated to do the Laramie Project. The principal at the very, you know, kind of last minute said, you can't do it. It will, quote-unquote, tear our community apart. And he was very worried about the language, even though many high schools have cut the cursing out. He was very worried about the impact that it would have on the kids that would come to see it. So he pulled it. And these kids called Tectonic. They called some national, or they called some media outlets. They called around. They got a really wonderful theater, I can't remember the name of it now, in L.A., to donate a space. And Lee and I flew out there and helped them stage the play and talk to them. And again, every time you come into a situation like that where these young kids, you know, a lot of whom are out in high school, which just astounds me, are really wanting to do this play and are fighting hard to do this play and have done all that those young women in that cast did to get this play done, and specifically those four young women, it's so profound that this play has had that kind of impact and really creates, you know, as Romaine talks about, like really creating political activism in these young people, which I think is just miraculous.
Well, and it creates change because now the principal has said that they'll do the play the next year.
There was a lot of media. There was a lot of media that covered this. All of the papers, including the LA Times. I mean, there were some big media outlets that covered this story. And I think, you know, you have a lot of cameras and a lot of interviews and a lot of people coming to interview these young women and the principal and, you know, get the down and dirty of the story, it really bends an arm much more quickly than if those things don't happen. Yeah. So that was a real coup on their behalf.
Yeah. And then you said there was something else that you wanted to
It makes me feel really emotional kind of talking about this because it is the 10-year and it seems just like yesterday. And this play, you know, how has it affected me other than just all the beautiful moments that I've had with people doing the play and talking to people doing the play and seeing, even if it's like a tiny little faucet trickle being turned on of people changing, you know, whether it's tolerance as opposed to true acceptance, whether it's I won't ever say the word faggot again ever after having seen this, you know, whether it's kids really rising up and fighting their way to do this play. But for me personally, like, it has made me a different person. It has made me a different gay person. And it, working on this play, creating this play, having the privilege of being involved in this play with all of these amazing people that I dearly, dearly love, it affects my everyday. It changed the trajectory of my life. It just literally changed my life. I was like walking one way. I met Lee. Then I got involved with the Laramie Project and my life went into a different direction. I will never be the same actor. I will never be the same person ever.
Yeah.
And that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, you got another 10 years to become, have it be even more amazing, I am sure. The legacy goes on. Lee Fondakowski traveled with some other members of Tectonic in the past couple of weeks out to Laramie. There's going to be an article in Newsweek magazine, which we'll talk about, a new op-ed piece about going back and interviewing the same people again 10 years later, just like I'm doing with Kelly. So we're going to do some news, and we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be back with Lee Fondakowski of Tectonic Theater Project and head writer on the Laramie Project. And Kelly wants to say one more thing.
I was just sitting here thinking while you were saying all that, that I think it's a very rare experience in one's lifetime to feel as if they have been part of something significant, part of something this altering, and meeting, you know, there are young kids that I've met, and this is not an ego thing, but who think we're rock stars who created the Laramie Project.
Oh, I've seen it over the past 4 years. I've seen people look at you.
How deeply this has gotten into a lot of people that have performed it and been involved with it. It's a very significant thing. And, you know, to have and it's not a gay play, but a play about a young gay man who was murdered, that has been co-opted as a part of our American theatrical lexicon is, you know, I think that's wonderful. And the significance of that, let alone just kind of the significance of feeling like I was a part of a company that created this, is just, there's just no words for that. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. We'll be back with Lee Fondakowski after this.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Overly Competitive Touch Football Game Player.
Mr. Overly Competitive Touch Football Game Player, yeah.
A little friendly competition never hurt anybody. Unless that anybody happens to be the person you're covering.
Bring the pain.
Hands, no. Blazing speed, no. Unresolved anger after being cut from the football team 17 years ago? Big time.
I still have issues.
When it comes to two-hand touch, you leave it all out on the field. Your blood, your sweat, your dignity.
Dignity is overrated.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, backyard bruiser. The way you play the game will always leave us in stitches.
Mr. Overly Competitive Touch Football Game Player.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Week in News.
During last week's vice presidential debate, although Sarah Palin said she is tolerant of gays and lesbians, she reiterated her anti-GLBT position on a number of issues, including her opposition to same-sex marriage and her support of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Although Senator Joe Biden stated that he also does not support same-sex marriage, he stressed that he thinks same-sex couples should be afforded equal rights under the law.
Republican presidential candidate Senator John McCain slammed gay and lesbian parents in an interview with the Washington Blade. McCain stated that he believes gays and lesbians don't make good parents. I believe a child is best raised by a mother and a father because of the unique contributions that they make together to the development of a child, he wrote. In July, McCain said that he doesn't believe gays and lesbians should be able to adopt children.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed a bill that would have honored gay civil rights pioneer Harvey Milk. The bill would have marked the activist's birthday, May 22nd, as Harvey Milk Day. Milk was assassinated along with San Francisco's Mayor George Moscone in 1977. Schwarzenegger said that he vetoed the bill because Milk's contributions, quote, should continue to be recognized at the local level.
American Airlines wrote Congress a letter of support for the passage of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. ENDA is currently under consideration. American Airlines, which employs over 80,000 people, was the first major airline to implement domestic partner benefits and to include both sexual orientation and gender identity in its non-discrimination policy.
A new study suggests that HIV/AIDS can be traced back 100 years. This new study in the journal Nature estimates the disease's origin back to between 1884 and 1924, but focuses on the year 1908. These estimates are during the rise of African cities. Previously, scientists estimated that the HIV/AIDS virus originated around 1930 and is descended from a chimpanzee virus.
Mexico's condomobile, or condommobile, was stolen recently in Mexico City. The vehicle, which has been dispensing condoms all over Mexico for a decade, was later recovered. However, roughly 5,000 condoms, as well as some medical equipment, were missing from the truck. Since the HIV awareness vehicle first started touring the country, over 1.2 million condoms have been given away.
R&B singer Shire has released a controversial new music video for her debut song, I Used to Love Her. Both the video and song explore the powerful intimacy and bonds between two women. The track is available now, but her debut album, Picking Up the Pieces, will be released in early 2009.
And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hey, this is Carson Kressley, and you're listening to the Windy City Queercast.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club.
Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
In the week of October 6th, 2008, you are in Chicago's Culture Club.
At Northlight Theater this Halloween season, one man's nightmares come to life in the classic psychological thriller Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. This fiendishly clever new adaptation will thrill audiences with the startling truth that there's a little Hyde in all of us. Playing through October 26th. For information, visit northlight.org.
Don't miss the Gift Theater's production of David Rabe's Streamers. It's 1965. Boot camp is over. Four young men wait for deployment to Vietnam. As anticipation, race, and sexuality climax at dizzying heights, a free fall begins that perhaps no man can survive. Visit thegiftstheater.org.
Remy Bumpo Theater presents the Chicago premiere The Voisey Inheritance by Harley Granville Baker, adapted by David Mamet. When do-gooder Edward Voisey learns of shady dealings within the family business, he is determined to set things right, but the rest of the family has other plans. The Voisey Inheritance is playing through November 2nd at the Victory Gardens Greenhouse Theater, 2257 North Lincoln Avenue. For tickets, visit remybumpo.org.
Beautiful circus ring mistress Miranda Towers had it all until her world came tumbling down and things went haywire. Don't miss Haywire, presented by Helena Handbag, for murder, melodrama, and an axe-wielding Joan Crawford under the big top. Playing now at the Bailiwick, 1229 West Belmont. For tickets, go to handbagproductions.org. Windy City Podcast listeners will get $5 off when they use the code WCP.
Playing now, Court Theater in Hyde Park is proud to present the Chicago premiere of Tony Kushner's Caroline or Change, starring Ife Butler. The Boston Globe calls this award-winning musical a masterpiece, and the show has extended. For tickets and information for Caroline or Change, visit courttheater.org.
For more Culture Club, visit windycitytimes.com.
So it's really amazing that here on the eve of the 10th anniversary of Matthew Shepard's murder, and as we're having a whole show here to remember Matthew and the legacy of his life, obviously having Kelly to talk to us a little bit about the creation of the Laramie Project, to also have on this show the head writer of the Laramie Project. Also, you all heard me talk a lot about the People's Temple over the past week, since she was the director and writer, creator of the People's Temple, the production about Jonestown that I just completed here. And it's really, really cool to have Lee Fondakowski for the first time on the QueerCast. How has that happened, Lee?
I don't know. You should have had me on sooner.
I know. I should have had you on sooner, but you're a very busy lady.
Yes.
And I wanted to talk to you about something amazing that you've just experienced, which is going back to Laramie 10 years later with all of you who conducted the interviews that became the Laramie Project. Talk to me about, you know, when was the decision to go back? Is that something you always thought you all would do?
Well, before I say that, I just want to say that it didn't hit me until just a little while ago that today is October 6th.
Yeah.
And I knew that all along, but...
Yeah, and the relevance of that is the actual day that he was
beaten. He was, well, the day that he went to the fireside bar and he was taken out onto the prairie. So that just kind of hit me a few minutes ago. I'm just really proud that we're doing this reading on this day.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you put this together.
Thanks.
But yeah, we just got back from Laramie. We finished writing the op-ed piece today,
which
will appear in Newsweek magazine next week. So five of us went back and interviewed almost everybody who we interviewed before, who was in Laramie, and we also did phone interviews with the people who had left Laramie. And it was Moises' idea. He, you know, as he did the first time, called us up and said, "Let's do this."
Yeah.
And we all did. A lot has changed in Laramie. When you first drive into Laramie, there's all this incredible development. There's like four or five brand new hotels and all these big buildings and a conference center. And it's like that little town that we knew that was so isolated and empty has like it's a boom town now because the energy, oil, gas, natural gas, it's like booming. The economy is booming in Wyoming as opposed to other places in the country right now. So things have really dramatically changed there.
So... had you been back in the 10 years?
I had been back, like, as passing through on all my travels, like driving cross-country with my dog.
Yes, you are.
I do.
You are somebody who drives cross-country. It's not because you're scared to fly. It's because you have a dog.
It's because I have my dog, so wherever I go to work, I take my dog with me. And I have stayed in Laramie a few times, which is basically, like, overnight off the highway and back on the highway. So I haven't really looked around town. Although you can get a terrific cup of coffee at the Cold Creek Coffee Shop in Laramie.
Oh, Wyoming. Yeah? The Cold Creek Coffee Shop.
Yeah, Cold Creek.
So, were people excited to see you all? I mean...
yeah, the people who we were in touch with, it was like seeing old friends. It was really deep. It was really profound. And I guess the thing that struck me the most was like seeing Kathy Conley, for example, who's a character in the play, and her deep sorrow that not more has changed. Like, deep sorrow. Heartbreak, almost, you know?
And she's an openly gay professor.
Is.
One of the first that
she
knew
of. The first
at the University, of Wyoming.
The thing that's hard is that for a few generations of students after this happened, the history of Matthew Shepard was very prescient. It was very, like, relevant. It was very important.
Uh-huh.
And over time... Partially due to a 2020 piece that came out about a year and a half ago.
I remember that. It was controversial.
It was very controversial. Elizabeth Vargas did this piece where she went and interviewed Aaron McKinney and said, "Was it a hate crime?" And he said, "No, it wasn't." She's like, "There, it's proven. It's not a hate crime." But this whole narrative that's kind of taken hold in Laramie that, oh, it was a drug deal gone bad, or it was about drugs, it was a robbery gone bad, about drugs, and trying to distance themselves from the fact that it was a hate crime. And it's pretty disturbing, you know? And we talked to the cops, and the cops were like, there was no methamphetamine in their blood. That, you know, we did all those tests. If it was a drug-related crime or a robbery gone bad, we would have prosecuted it as such. We wouldn't have made up the hate component.
Right.
So it's pretty striking to see that narrative, especially with young people, take such root.
Has anything happened with legislation in Laramie?
No,
or in
nothing
Wyoming
has happened in Wyoming.
Hate crimes or
no? There's an anti-discrimination ordinance that went through the city council. It was more like a proclamation. We won't tolerate this here.
Right.
It doesn't really have that much legal implication. On a state level, I met with the governor of Wyoming, and he is opposed to hate crime legislation. He's a Democrat. He's opposed to it because he doesn't believe that the prosecution should have to prove anything more beyond a reasonable doubt. So he thinks if you make it a hate crime, you really make the job of the prosecutors much more difficult. So he believes in enhanced penalties. And he had a very, you know, reasonable view of that. And he said, you know, "I know it doesn't have the same symbolic value, but it's easier to prosecute that way.
And maybe justice is better served that way,"
maybe
is what he thinks.
Right. And then the federal, the Matthew Shepard Act, which in 2007 passed the Senate, passed the House, and then when Bush threatened to veto it, that Congress dropped it. So that's legislation that's still hanging out that never has gone, you know, in front of the president to be signed. So there isn't that real concrete change. But one of the things that John Peacock said, who was Matthew Shepard's academic advisor, he said you can't only measure change by that kind of qualitative change, like if there was a law passed or an ordinance. You have to measure change on an individual basis, almost heart by heart.
That's beautiful.
It's basically what our piece is about in the Newsweek piece is how do you measure change and the personal transformations that have come as a result of this happening across the world, in Laramie and across the country and around the world, are so significant.
Right.
Personal transformation, that's the kind of thing that's hard to qualify, but it's still, you know, it still is very real. We all feel it. All of us who just did rehearse the reading,
right.
We all feel Matthew in our hearts.
Yeah.
We are changed as a result of reading this play, of contemplating his life and his death. So
right.
Change is a hard thing to measure, to put your finger on, but it's happening.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, I would imagine too, I mean, this is the Laramie Project, and we're sitting backstage between a rehearsal with amazing actors and amazing About Face queer youth theater youth, and we're going to do the reading now for a full house of people to hear this tonight. This play is one of the 10 most produced plays in the U.S., at least. I don't know, probably maybe the world, who knows. A lot of people have played these individuals, you know, who have now gone on to have lives. Did any of them talk about that, about the fact that, you know, obviously we talk about Matthew Shepard becoming iconic, but John Peacock has become iconic, as has Romaine Patterson, even if she didn't have a show on Sirius OutQ, or so has Rebecca Hilliker, mm-hmm. or, you know, Ruland Stacey, who, you know, had to tell everybody in the news media that he had died. Did you sense any of that, of changing?
Yeah,
them?
We talked about that a lot. Zaki Salmon went through her email box. She receives, you know, close to 30 emails a month.
Wow.
Just people constantly. What do you like? What's it like there? How have things changed?
I'm playing you in the play. I'm sure we talk about how many people have played these people, if you could line them up.
And they're so accessible because of the internet and different things. You just Google Zaki Salmon and you have access to her, you
right.
know? But Kathy Conley told a funny story of a student coming. She's running for a state house seat.
Oh, cool.
In Wyoming. It looks like has a really good chance to win, actually.
Wow.
And so she was giving some kind of panel, informational panel. And it was all the federal elections were there, too. Everybody was there. And the Republican who's running for Senate in Wyoming, his daughter came up to Kathy Conley after the panel and said, "I tried out for you in my high school, but I didn't get the part."
I love it.
So Kathy was like, "Okay, now go back to your father, who's a Republican."
Yeah.
And, you know, set the record straight. So it's interesting for those people to have that kind of interplay in their lives of people coming up to them who have played them or who mm-hmm. feel like they know them. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's trippy, and we did talk a lot about that. We're actually going to create a second epilogue to the play.
I was going to ask, what are you going to do besides writing the op-ed piece for Newsweek? I mean, are you going to change
We're not going to change the script. The script will remain intact, but we'll make another published version that has the 10-year later epilogue.
Wow.
And then when people do the production, they can either print the text, or they can perform the text, or they can figure out how they want to use that text in relationship to the play. But
yeah.
We're going to write another epilogue, and we're going to premiere it in New York at a Tectonic benefit on December 1st.
Oh,
so
wow. That's
we
beautiful.
Haven't started writing it yet because we've been totally focused on getting the article written.
So everybody pick up Newsweek.
Yes, everybody pick up Newsweek next Monday. But there's some
actually, it'll be this week.
This week. It'll be out this week. Good.
The magic of podcasting.
The magic of podcasting.
Yes.
But the epilogue is going to be really, really beautiful. You know, the fence has been taken down. There's no remnant
There's no
of it
fence.
Anywhere. There's no fence. And Jonas Sloniker, who's a gay man, who's also a character in the play, he said that he would go to that spot, mm. even though there was no fence there, and he would sit there and he would contemplate. And one day it just occurred to him that he needed to let that place go.
Wow.
And he had said this line that people's poetry, just natural poetry, will never cease to amaze me. But he said 10 years of snow and rain have washed through that place. And now
wow.
it's just a place. It's just a place. And I had
wow.
to let it go. And I can hear the epilogue. I can hear their voices already.
Yeah.
Creating. They're
well,
writing the epilogue.
Their voices, you know, though. You
exactly.
know, what's beautiful is that they're voices that you know telling you the next page.
Exactly.
You know, telling you the next chapter.
That's exactly
which
right.
Which is really the beautiful thing. I love that you seem to be fascinated. I don't know if it originated with Laramie or if this is something before, but you really seem fascinated with community. You know, I know that I've talked a lot about that on the podcast about People's Temple and how, you know, you can get so caught up in the icon, which, you know, at that point it would be maybe Jim Jones, and in this play it might be Matthew Shepard, but that the play is about
we as people, like our humanity. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you find personally theatrical and more interesting to show the interactions of a community?
I think that the natural human desire for community is so universal. I mean, it's just such a universal thing. We all want mm-hmm. that. Like, it's, you know, the thing that we long for. It's the thing that I want in the theater, working in the theater. It's the thing that I wanted, you know, in my family, that when I was kicked out of my family, tried to find in my queer community.
So you were kicked out for being gay?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean...
So you've had that experience, which is iconic, but for many people.
Yeah, especially, I think for our generation, we're on that cusp of mm-hmm. people who still had those kind
of
things.
The Reagan generation.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know. I don't know if it's so much the people that I meet end up in these dramas that revolve around community, but I'm eternally fascinated with human nature, human beings, with ordinary people who end up in extraordinary circumstances and how they behave mm-hmm. in those circumstances, sometimes like heroically and sometimes not so heroically.
Yeah.
And that conversation, I think, is a really relevant one for the stage because it so much mirrors life. It is life.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, this is my 10th anniversary of doing gay radio. And even though I do gay podcasting now, to me it's the same thing. And what I realize, you know, Matthew Shepard was a turning point for me covering the trial every day within the first year of doing this, of kind of going, I'm not just talking, you know. I was kind of hired to be a weather girl with a brain who's gay to tell people what to do in the scene, you know. And then it shifted, I think, with Matthew. And it's interesting. There goes my phone, folks. See how popular I am? It's my groovy little gay ring.
My sister said that the young people call that blowing up.
Blowing up?
When your phone starts going off a lot, you're like, oh, you're blowing up right now.
In a bad moment. but no, I was going to say that, you know, to give voice to the community is what I really started realizing that it was about. You know, it was about giving voice, and I think that that's what you all did so beautifully with Laramie. You know, it could have just been written off as a town, you know, where this thing happened that was so horrific, and yet giving voice to it, it's become so much more complicated and beautiful and messy and vulnerable. And I'm realizing in this moment, I guess I'm rambling, but I'm realizing in this moment that, you know, it's a very similar thing. Mine are just usually not about extraordinary things, except I do find all the people I interview extraordinary.
Yeah, of course.
But I love talking to everyday people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of what it's been about, giving everyday GLBT people mm-hmm. a place to talk. Mm-hmm.
The things that are talked about in this play, I think, are important things. It's not the stuff that you see in most plays, that kind of passionate conversation about the state of our culture, basically, and the state of our society. So that, to me, is the exciting thing about Laramie, having all those different voices. And then when young people play that they get to play Fred Phelps, and they get to play Jonas Sloniker, and those two characters can be in the same play and have the same conversation.
Yeah, and it's a debate, right? I mean, it's kind of a debate. I remember, like, even when you were I took debate class in high school, and you had to argue a side you really didn't believe. And as actors, when you're playing so many different roles, mm-hmm. sometimes you play people that you don't like or you don't believe in.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a tangent, but
no.
The thing about communities, I also think it's present in history. It's not just present in the current events, but it's present in history. Like, if you think about Charlotte Cushman, 19th century lesbian, who's the subject of the next play, community. Like, that's what they were looking for, those women. They wanted community, as artists, as women, you know? Yeah. So I think it's just something that's so true about us as human beings. We need to be together.
Yeah, and find out what our common threads are.
Yeah.
You know, for Laramie, it happened to be a town, you know, that either knew Matt or knew these boys or knew people like all three of those boys,
right?
And you know, it's just interesting, you know, that's where we find our connection. Well, I'm so glad that you were able to fly in and direct this
reading. Thank you, Amy.
For those people who got
I'm
to
so
see it.
I'm so glad you're in it.
I am so glad to be in it. I'm so glad it's happening. It's actually
so
been
glad
a
you
dream.
Just stole another part in the 11th hour.
I stole another part. It's okay. Kelly won't miss it. But it's just really nice to have this moment to reflect on 10 years, and hopefully all of you listening can think back where you were in October of 1998 and what's changed in your life, you know, and also what have we done to kind of fill the good works that Matthew Shepard would have done. You know, and they said he would have probably been a political activist and a
you know, have we made our mark? So we have to be people of action. That's really, to me, what Matthew's legacy is about.
Yes.
So thanks.
Thank you, Amy.
We will talk again on your next project.
Yes.
Hey there, I'm Deb Pierce, Toronto's official queer respondent. I've been keeping you plugged into what's hot in Toronto this summer, and summer may be coming to a close, but Toronto is just starting to get warmed up. It's still hot, and so is our event lineup. Toronto is preparing for Nuit Blanche Festival, where one sleepless night our city is transformed by artists in some of the most extraordinary and unexpected places. It all starts at sunset on October 4th, one night only, all night long. You also won't want to miss Halloween, our week-long Halloween festival in the heart of our gay village. Think costumes, cocktails, and more eye candy than you can gobble in one glance. Want to find out more about our great city? Visit www.torontotourism.com. Hope to see you soon!
So this has been a special QueerCast honoring the 10th anniversary and legacy of Matthew Shepherd. It's a story that continues to live on, a work that continues to live on through his legacy of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation, started by his family, his mother, who is the driving force, Judy Shepherd, behind that. And she has been on our QueerCast before a couple of times, and also I've interviewed her over the years. So I think one of the wonderful things that you can do wherever you are, if you're not in a town where somebody is having a candlelight vigil for Matthew, or you can't go see a reading of the play, though it's still being produced, so it might not happen this week, but it might happen in the next 6 months. It's definitely worth hearing anyone from high school to college, professional company, read this play or perform this play. You know, or maybe this week you just want to sit down and have a moment, think about Matthew, light a candle, watch the HBO film, whatever you have access to. I definitely encourage people to check onto the Matthew Shepherd website, matthewshepherd.org, I think is the website. We'll have it linked on our show notes. And you can, you know, see that, and also look for the Newsweek article that's coming out as well. So whatever, in whatever way it is meaningful to you to honor the legacy of Matthew Shepherd, I hope you're able to do that, whether that's with your time or just your silence or your activism or your checkbook. You can make a donation. Or in talking to your legislatures. The Matthew Shepherd bill did not, Matthew Shepherd Act did not get passed. Hopefully with our new administration, perhaps that will happen. So we'll be talking about Matthew Shepherd in our next show. So until then, have a great day.
Thanks for listening to another Windy City QueerCast. This program is brought to you in part by Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming. Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com. And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow. Special thanks to our QueerCast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, Amy Wooten, news editor, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueerCast.com and iTunes. The next QueerCast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City QueerCast. Queer and now.